Welcome to Building Better Businesses, an ABA podcast. Learn firsthand from business owners who built successful ABA businesses. Utilize proven techniques and strategies to help your practice thrive. This is Building Better Businesses in ABA podcast with Jonathan Mueller.
Ryan Gilliam is the VP of Revenue Cycle Management at Element RCM. And prior to that, he and his wife owned an ABA business for 8 years in Jacksonville, Florida, before successfully selling to a local ABA company. Ryan's favorite movie is Tombstone, his favorite weekend activity, chess, and his guilty pleasure is Krispy Kreme donuts. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Jonathan. I appreciate that warm intro there.
Well, before we get to your experience owning an ABA company, Ryan, I know sports was a huge part of your life growing up. Tell me about sports and what they meant to you.
Yeah, so I'm from Tallahassee, Florida. Most folks only know about Tallahassee for, like, you know, politics being the state capital and FSU football, right? Florida State football, Bobby Bowden. So I grew up, you know, in that town where pretty much if you were breathing and you were a boy, you played football. So that was life. And I was blessed to go to a pretty cool high school that was really successful in football, won some state championships. And six of my childhood friends, classmates, teammates, all went on to play in the NFL within like a 3-year span period. And I was one of the guys who was supposed to do that and did not do it. Like, it was not in the cards for me. So that kind of impacted me. So, like, in sports taught me not just like friendship, competitiveness, and discipline, but it also taught me how to fail, right? So it's something that's really helped me in business by failing early and then, like, still having to recover and come back and still show up and be my best self every day.
I want to come back to that idea about failure in a moment, but you've got this crazy story about meeting Phil Knight. And for our listeners, Phil Knight is one of the founders of Nike. Can you share that, man?
Yeah, so in high school, I was a pretty cool, pretty big recruit. And at the time, I was committed to Florida State. And Oregon was trying to take a flyer on me and say, hey, will you come out here and take a visit? And so I was like, okay, I'll take a visit to Oregon, which at the time was just like unheard of for a guy from Florida to go to Oregon on a recruiting visit. And they sent a town car to my house. I'm 17, so, like, think of this. I've never been in a town car before. It's got the phone in it, the whole deal, right? And then I go to this private airport in Tallahassee I didn't know existed, and there's waiting this fancy jet. And when I get on, you know, I'm greeted by a nice stewardess and some folks that say, hey, this is Phil Knight's private jet, like, dead serious. And I'm like, what? Like, the dude that owns Nike? And so, yeah, I fly on his private jet. I have, like, filet mignon and hot dogs and french fries. Don't ask me why that was a combination I asked for. But they wanted to give me a good steak, and I had never had filet mignon before. So that was my experience. It was a long flight, but it was a short flight, direct flight to Eugene, Oregon. And I get off the plane, and I get an opportunity not just meet the Oregon football team staff and so forth and so on, but I got to have some cool conversations with Phil Knight. And throughout my experience at Oregon while I played football there, I got to go to his ranch a couple times and have some pretty cool conversations with him. But yeah, Phil Knight flew me on his private jet to come on my trip. And as a result, I committed to go to Oregon because it's Phil Knight's jet, right?
What's going through your head as a 17-year-old who's, like, on this private jet eating filet mignon? What emotions are you experiencing?
You know, honestly, like, I didn't know, like, that was my second recruiting trip. The only other recruiting trip at that time I had done was, like, my hometown, Florida State. So, like, I didn't know at the time, like, that was, like, a big deal. Like, I knew it was a big deal, but I didn't know it was a big deal compared to, like, flying commercial and stuff, because I hadn't had an opportunity to do all that. So I thought, like, is this how it's supposed to be every time? Like, no. Everybody doesn't send town cars and private jets to you. But that's, like, at 17, that was my main impression, was just, like, this is pretty nice. And then, to be honest with you, I never seen kind of money like that before. You know, like, luxury wealth, not, like, rich, but, like, wealth. Just had never experienced anything like that. So for me, it was like something like, hey, I could get used to this. So that was the main takeaways I had at 17.
Tell me more about your time at the University of Oregon. And did that end up the way you had hoped it would end?
No, I mean, it was a cool time, right? You know, so, you know, you're, you know, freshman, sophomore in college, and you're figuring it out. I think coming from Florida, Eugene, it was culture shock, right? So, if you guys don't know, like Eugene is like a very diverse place. It's not, you know, think of it as little Seattle is a way of thinking of it, right? So, got to meet people and interact with people that I just never did it before. So that part was really fun. One thing I didn't know, like is that it rains for every day for 4 months out of the year. Like I heard of stuff like that, but I didn't know like the Pacific Northwest was like the weather was really that. So that kind of got to me. And then obviously the cold, like compared to that. But so I was only there for 2.5 years, before I transferred, but my time there was great. Great friends, great memories. Some people that I'll never forget, right? Just the folks you know, not just play with, but folks you know, when you go to college, like you meet some lifelong friends. So great experiences, but I was cold and I wanted to go home.
Tell me, and so you moved back to Florida, right? And you played football a little more, but you also ran track. Was that true?
Yeah, I ran track at Oregon as well. I ran track throughout all college. I was one of those rare dual sport athletes. You know, I had a football scholarship as well as a track scholarship. I could be on either one. So yeah, it was just a part of what I did. I was, I've never only done one thing at a time. So like if a student athlete normally just plays their sport and goes to school, I played both my sports. I went to school full time, obviously. And I was one of the ones who had to have internships and externships in the off season. So I was definitely busy in college, but yeah, USF, I was able to do some cool things on the field and on the track, but, you know, become an academic All-American as well. So I'm really proud about excelling in the classroom as well as on the field.
You know, Ryan, I like to say that I like to think of supervisors, and especially in our ABA field, as coaches, because I think coaching behaviors are some of the most powerful and impactful behaviors a supervisor could demonstrate. Tell me about a couple of your coaches and pinpoint what was it that made them a great coach. And maybe contrast to someone who is not a great coach.
All right. So first of all, let me just tell you guys that I have been blessed to be like shepherded by so many different coaches who had different styles throughout my collegiate career and even high school. Obviously through track and football, you have different demeanors, right? Different approaches. But one of the first coaches that really made an impact on me was Jim Leavitt, head football coach at University of South Florida. He has a PhD in psychology, and he will never tell you he does. And most people don't think of coaches, right, in that standpoint of like, you know, shrinks. But as a clinician, he understood how to push your buttons. And so with me, he never talked to me about football. He never kind of communicated with me and pushed me on the field. He pushed me academically. Like he always would like try to get me over and over again to be like great in the classroom. And like if we were in the hallway, if we were in meeting rooms, he was always like, hey, you know, why don't you have straight A's this semester? You know, like that was his conversation. And he was like, you know, if you can't excel in the classroom, you'll never do good on the field for me. And like for me, because I cared so much at the time about football, and even though I was doing good at school, I wasn't doing my best. He felt like the only way I would ever do my best in football is if I applied that to other areas of my life that I wasn't, you know, and I didn't get it, you know, at 20 and 21 years old. Right. But as a grown man, I get it now. He knew what he was doing. There was some methods to the madness there. And it's got me to the point now where I don't just accept mediocrity in other areas of my life. Like we tend to only want to work at what we're good at. And he was showing me, hey, you got to work in the areas you're not good at. And I really appreciated that. And I won't say a bad coach, but something that I found that working with coaches that wasn't something that I gleaned from or probably added to my repertoire, but more said, hey, this isn't for me, is like talking to people as if like they're not human. And in sports, you get that. We think of that as from a military standpoint. We think if we down somebody enough, they'll respond. Some people do that way, but I think most people don't. And so that's something that I saw throughout my career that probably wasn't something that I agree with, or because I feel like you have to build people up and not just knock them down all the time. And I really appreciate those coaches that were about building and not, you know, hurting.
Right. I got to rewind. So Jim Leavitt, your football coach, is not talking about football. Mm-hmm. He's primarily talking to you about academics. Tell me, how did he build that relationship with you and get to know you to know that that was what he needed to coach you on.
So he was playing a mind trick on me. So I transferred from University of Oregon to South Florida. And when I did, when I first got there, I didn't have a place to stay. So I stayed with him. Literally, I was on his couch, for maybe, 3 weeks or something before they got me an apartment and everything. And, his deal to me was, he says, you can do anything you want to do. You're a smart guy, but you'll never be great. Like Ryan, there's a difference between people who are average and who people excel. You'll never be great until you really, really, excel in the classroom. And it made no sense to me because like every other coach I've ever talked to was always like, get my technique or my form or like really focusing me on like getting in the weight room or getting faster or something. And he was like, yeah, that stuff is fine. Like, who cares? Like, but are you going to be a good father? Are you going to be, a good provider? Like, are you going to be a good husband? I'm like, dude, what are you doing? I don't get this. Like, this makes no sense to me. But what the characteristics that take somebody to be a good football player is somebody that understands how to follow through and somebody that understands how to be disciplined and show up every day and just like do the work and get better. And those are the characteristics you need in the classroom. Those are characteristics that excel with an employer. And so that's what I took away from it. Like as an adult, like growing, but at the time it was really frustrating because I would want him to connect with me through football, but he was like, that's irrelevant to me. Like I know you know how to do that, but let's focus on the areas that you're not and that you need to grow and build at. And so it's really impactful now. And I really appreciate what he did because now my natural disposition is to look at the areas I'm not as strong in and always try to learn because that's where he kind of would take me to instead of like focusing and saying, hey, I'm great at this and not focusing in those other areas. So it was a reverse mind trick, but it kind of worked.
Dude, it sounds like he was your first life coach. I mean, that idea of like follow through discipline,
yeah.
Do the work.
Yeah.
So let's fast forward to how did starting an ABA business even enter your consideration set?
Oh man, I married a terrific woman. Alicia Gilliam's my wife. She's a BCBA and she's got a couple of other alphabets after her name. I can't say enough. Not just because she's my wife, but she was most people don't become a BCBA at 23. She was. And it wasn't like, hard for her. She graduated from college early, got her master's early. Like she did her undergrad in like 2.5 years. Like when the rest of us were like still going and partying, she was like volunteering at the 911 helpline just to figure out, right? She knew at 17 what she was going to do. So like the point is she wanted to start her own practice. She had been doing this stuff for a couple of years and wanted to start her own practice. And she didn't want to do anything dealing with like operations or dealing with insurance companies, or heck, she needed somebody to be her janitor and her secretary and everything else. And I was doing pretty cool in my career, but I knew that like, hey, being a business owner is like an entrepreneur. That's the goal, right? You want to work for yourself and control your schedule and obviously make a little money and help people along the way. And my wife had a passion about it. I knew nothing about ABA at all. Like didn't know the first thing, but I knew if I could just like get out of her way and allow her to like be great, because I thought she was amazing, we could be successful. And so in 2009 we took the leap, got a SBA small business loan, and like just like we're gonna open up a clinic and see what happens. It was me, her, and one client, 15 months later, we had like 50 employees and 2 offices. It happened really fast, but one of the best experiences of my life.
And you and Alicia had known each other since high school, is that right?
Yeah, we're high school sweethearts, man. She can't get rid of me. she's not gonna get rid of me. I always joke with our kids, and I said, I've been stalking your mom since we were 16. But yeah, we've been together now over 20 years and married almost 15 years, going on 15 years here, a couple months. And we got married young. And, I joke and I say I married up, man. I really married somebody who's a great teacher. But not just from an ABA standpoint, but with providers. But I also married somebody who's like the most understanding and grateful person that I've ever met. Like she knows how to see me at my worst and still see the best in me and bring me along the way. And so that really helped us earlier in our business as I grew and learned, right? Like, and I was able to like figure out how to work with insurance companies, how to partner with employees and just do all the things you need to do as a business owner. She provided me the latitude that I needed to like fail and fail forward and fail fast and not be ridiculed. So when you have a business partner, when you just have a partner in life, right, you're going to see them not do things right. And are you going to ridicule them? Or are you going to like resent them? Or are you going to, you know, bring them along? And she brought me along, right, in the best way she could. And so we wouldn't have been as successful if she didn't have the demeanor she had, because I was the one making the mistakes because I was the one new. Right. We never owned a business. We're young and she knows her part, but I don't know my part. So I tip my hat to her and how she handled herself in those first couple of years, because it really allowed us to grow and thrive and just help so many different families in the community.
It's pretty common in the ABA field that husband and wife teams will start a business. And I mean, like it gives me goosebumps thinking about it, right? Because having a business partner is one thing. Having a life partner, a spouse, is another like whole different thing. And you're bringing both of those together. So tell me, if you could go back to Ryan of 2009, right as you all were launching, and you thought about the relationship you had with her as a business partner, what would you tell yourself back then?
Clock out. Don't bring work home. Don't bring work home. Like we struggled in the beginning of separating the lines between like, you know, as business partners versus, you know, spouses. Like at home, my wife's submissive and she's like, hey, you're the head of the house. You're my husband kind of thing. We're from the South. So we kind of have those dynamics from that standpoint. And, but at work, she was a CEO. I was a COO. Like she was, obviously it's her field, her passion. Like this is her deal, right? So it was like, how does this work? And it took us time to figure it out. It took us time to realize like, hey, like if you you're really good here, you do this and you're going to take those, right? And, you know, how do you do that and not like be prideful when like, you know, things don't go your way or vice versa. And that if I could go back, I would really like really want myself to understand that, hey, look, you cannot be your wife's, husband at work, like in the middle of like a 10 o'clock meeting because your pride's hurt. Like you, that just doesn't work. It's just not going to be productive. And I think, you know, we figured it out, but it took some time.
And that's easier said than done, right? I mean, what were the specific things that you and she commitments say, or that you all agreed on, or things that you did to bring that to life, that separation?
That's a great, great question. So tangibly, we had some ground rules, right? We established some ground rules. For one of the first ground rules we established is we would stay in our own yard. So if, once you think of this analogy for a second, when you drive down the street, you look at all these freshly manicured yards, you won't go in someone else's yard and like manicure their yard for them. They get to cut their own grass, trim their own edges, right? You get that? So like when someone is operating a certain part of the business, you don't go and tell them what they're doing right and what they're doing wrong. So we call it stay in your yard. And, you signed up to be their business partner, so you get their successes and the failures that come along with being their partner, and you sign up for that. And that was like one of our main rules. It was like, hey, I am not going to second guess you in front of everybody else. I have 1,000% have your back, and if there's something we disagree with, we talk about it offline, not in front of the team, or you know, obviously anyone like that. So that was the first rule that we really set up that we still live to this day, like stay in your yard. The second one was, hey, you know, what happens at work does not have any reflection on our relationship. Now, how you live that out is like you have to understand, like, just because, you know, I disagree with you here doesn't mean I don't want to have dinner with you tonight. Mm. like healthy discourse is okay. Like if I want to open a new office and you don't, right, that doesn't mean that I don't love you. It doesn't mean that I don't care about you and I want to spend the rest of my life with you. It just means that I have a different viewpoint of this strategy, of this business venture, or whatever the case may be. And so, like, what we've learned to do is something called work talks, where we would separate all the other things, and we had some kind of 7 steps we would follow, and then we would come to a situation where we would both have a win-win, and we wouldn't have leave one person leaving the conversation where I feel like I was taken advantage of, or I feel like I gave in. So now you got this win. I got to win the next time. We got rid of all that kind of stuff by having what we call work talks, which allowed us to really communicate, get on the same page, and make sure we didn't go forward with anything that the other person felt like they were losing. Because if she loses, I lose, and vice versa. So those are the two things. Stay in your own yard and having work talks, it really allowed us to grow, thrive, and be great partners.
Ryan, this is profound wisdom, especially for people in their 20s and 30s, right? Owning a business for the first time. Did you come up with this on your own? Or was it just the school of hard knocks? Did you have a coach separately, or psychologist or therapist who was working with you?
No, like everybody else, we had counseling and pastors, from a church standpoint or clinical standpoint, we all of the above, right? And we figured out over time, trial and error and a lot of mistakes, like life, right? What worked best for us. And there were things we tried along the way that would work for a couple of weeks or a couple of months and then it wouldn't work anymore. But those were the two things that like really stood to the test of time. But I want to like just encourage everyone to like find people that you can glean from and learn from, that you respect and that have been there and done that. So we found folks in our community that had, obviously couples that were married and business together that we could like, hey, tell us what we're doing wrong. Like we're having these issues, right? And not just in the ABA space, because, you know, folks that have other businesses can also give a lot of feedback. And then obviously we have a strong faith in our family and in Christ. And so we obviously went to our church and was like, hey, how do we make sure that we don't grow a great business, but to have a really bad marriage, right? Like, what's the point, right? If you get financially and you really help some folks and some kiddos get some great services, but in the families are, everybody's happy, but you're suffering in your marriage. Like that's not the dream. So we made a conscious effort to seek help, and not just like push it to the side. Because what most folks do, and what we almost did, is we're gonna have this great business but not have a great marriage. And we decided, no, we're gonna put the same amount of work in our marriage that we're putting into this business. Because it takes work. And you got to make those conscious efforts, and both people have to decide that the marriage is more important than the business, and the business isn't. Because if the business is more important, the marriage will suffer. But if the marriage is more important, you'll like each other enough to make the business better. You can't make a business better if you don't want to be with your partner. And so that's what we learned through counseling. That's what we learned through loving. And that's really what helped us be successful.
Ryan, how did you create an environment, not just in your business partnership relationship, but in your organization, where it was okay to fail?
I lived it. I felt so. I mean this, like so many people like feel like they have to know everything, or like they have to be subject matter experts to be an entrepreneur. And I'm sorry, I just don't have that train of thought. I have the train of thought like, hey, if you're willing to do the work and you're willing to learn, you can grow and thrive and all these kind of things. So we had an atmosphere. We had a community of folks who were all learning, and we were a young team. We're a young leadership team. So it was like, hey, I'm learning, you're learning, and it's okay to make mistakes as long as you learn from them. And so we lived that out through like not hiding our mistakes from our team. Now, there were some strong benefits to that because folks felt comfortable in the psychological environment to that they could learn and grow. But there were some downsides to that too. It's not all rainbows. Folks felt like, well, you guys, how do I know you guys really got this? Like, how do I know we have a really strong business here? Because, everything isn't, what it seems sometimes. And so you have to balance those two things. And if I could go back, I would definitely not share as much with the kind of the core team as early as we did, because we wanted everybody to feel so safe. But, like everything in life, like nothing, everything in moderation, right? Nothing in over and abundance is good for you. But yeah, that's what we did. We lived it out. We didn't hide stuff from them. And I think it really helped them. Now, to this day, years later, I think we still have a great deal of respect in our community and from our team members from doing that, right? I think we have a great name for that. I also would tell you that some folks know what we're talking about because we've lived it. You live failures, you learn from failures. And I think that was one of the best things I took away from it.
What was the biggest failure you had in the business and what did you learn from it?
Ooh, where do you want to start? The biggest one that I had was payer mixes, right? So essentially payer mixes is where you look at your you know, your private, you know, we all know private pay and ABA isn't that big, but right, your private pay versus your insurance, Medicaid versus private insurance. And I didn't take enough time to care early enough about, hey, not getting too top heavy in one payer versus another. I let our Medicaid get too high. Like, I let our Medicaid, you know, become too big of a percentage of our revenue. And what happened was they cut the Medicaid rates, right? So now we've built a business around growth. We built a business around clinical quality that requires a certain amount of revenue and cash flow. And now that it's been impacted like that because I didn't set up the right parameters around payer mixes. And it's like, at the time, I was like, I didn't know what a payer mix was. You know what I mean? So that's the kind of things, like, you don't know what you don't know until you don't know it. And you can go to school and you can get all the degrees you want. I've been blessed to have an MBA and all that. But until you live it, sometimes you don't really know. And that was one of the biggest mistakes, I think, that kept us from, like, really going to the next level at the time we wanted to go to. And we recovered from it and all is fine as well. But the point is, you got to know and structure those things the same way you do your budget, right? You got to put parameters in place. So if TRICARE decides to do something, change a rule on you and not allow you, like they did recently, to provide services in schools, you're not, you know, out there, you know, with your hand in the wind, right? You've got some fall safes, or not fall safes, you got some ability to pivot. And that's one of the biggest things I learned was, or I'm sorry, one of the biggest failures was not having payer mixes set up.
So that's powerful advice. And one of your responsibilities was overseeing revenue cycle management, right? Billing and authorizations, yeah, and scheduling. And I know you experienced great successes and maybe some failures there too. Tell me more about what your role overseeing revenue cycle and billing.
So, you know, my wife saw everything clinically and I had everything else. So anything in the clinical world, obviously, she took care of and I took care of everything else. So from a revenue cycle standpoint, it was my baby. And there were different times over the 8 years where I would outsource to a vendor and not be happy with what they did, right? And then bring it in-house. But when you bring something in-house, you've got to own it, right? You've got, even if you're hiring people, you got to know how to do it yourself. So I took the approach as, like, I would be our biller. I would do authorizations. I would do the benefit checks. I would do it until I knew it inside and out. And then I not just could train someone, but I could know if somebody was taking too long to do something, or I could know if somebody wasn't doing it to the level of the standard they should do it. And it's easy for me because it's how I paid my mortgage, right? I was motivated to be great at it, right? It's how I made sure I had a roof over my head. So that was kind of my stance, right? And so, like, when a vendor would tell me, oh, that's just this, I'd be like, no, actually, it's not. You know, so that was the biggest part for me, getting there, getting my hands dirty and living it and doing it. So for 3 years, I did all the billing myself. And that was a process that was crazy because, you know, at the time, obviously, we, you know, from a national standpoint, you know, insurance ABA billing was still new. We're still figuring it out. So it was every different provider having a different provider manual with different rules. It was interesting, but
you have your hand.
It was something I'm glad I experienced.
Yeah, you know. as a business owner, you had a hand on one of the key levers, right? I mean, it's kind of unsexy work, and at the same time, like, you need to see cash in your bank account in order to make your next payroll. What'd you learn that you would want every other ABA provider to know?
Bill often, like, don't bill once a week. Like, I know it, like, that's like what we all go to, right? Like, some folks are, you know, 2 weeks. Most folks bill every week, but try to bill every 2 days. It's just health. The health of your revenue cycle will just improve dramatically. It's not easy to get the providers. It's not easy to get the team from a back office standpoint on that. But once you do it, once you cross that hurdle, it will make your life so much better. Because all the problems and the lags that you typically see, they're all shortened because you're billing quicker, right? Cash flow increases because you have more money coming in on a consistent pace. So one of the first things, especially as a smaller organization, before you get bigger, try to get on that pace, all right, right, of billing every 2 days. Once you're a bigger organization, once you have over 100 clients, once you know, we all know in multiple states, it's harder to kind of you know, we all know like how our federal government is, right? It's hard to move a big boat, right? You have a lot more moving pieces and a lot of people. But when you're smaller, like go ahead and do the work to get where you can bill every 2 days or multiple times a week. And it'll truly make it. I know it helped me sleep better at night. I believe it might do the same thing for you.
And I know, so you had it in-house, the billing function in-house for 3 years, but then you also worked with outside vendors. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give to ABA providers when evaluating a potential vendor and partner in revenue cycle?
Where do I begin? Okay, so we had horror stories. We had vendors steal from us. I mean, I hate to like to bring that up, but it's like the reality. Don't ever let a vendor tell you the money should come to them and then they'll give you a check. Like in 2010, a company called Wellspring did that, and Wellspring stole from a lot of providers. They didn't, you know, they were an ABA provider in California. They had their own issues going on with their California Medicaid, and it hurt providers throughout the country. But these things happen. So that's the first thing, right? Don't let the money go to them and then, you know, come back to you. Second thing I would say is understand how their teams are set up. So they're telling you that you're going to get more than you pay for. All right. Who works for you? What is their experience? And not only what is their experience, but will we have access to them? Because if they have one person doing it for them and that person leaves, then you're in a worse spot than you started, because now your team isn't ready to take it on, right? And then they don't have anyone on their side that it can actually fill in if that person leaves. So the staffing concerns you have about your organization, you should have those same concerns about any vendor you partner with. And the third thing that I would say is like really important to understand and ask, not just on the interview process, but as you work with them, is their methodology about how they do what they do. Like, what is the method of the madness? Like, why do they approach things the way they approach them? And we all know when we talk to a mechanic or we talk to anybody else who's a professional, we know BS when we hear it, right? Like, you know, if somebody's like, oh, we do this and we do that, it's like, you're not saying anything. If they sound like the politician who's not really giving you any substance, it might be that they're not subject matter expert in ABA. ABA billing is different than speech. It's different than OT. It's different than PT. It's different than social work, you know, family health counseling. So if they are not ABA billers, they might not be the best company for you. Just those are my three things.
Ryan, how did you decide to sell your business?
It was my wife's decision. We had a string of things that, and we obviously we partnered on the choice, right? When I say it was her baby, like, you know, this is her career and so forth and so on. We started the practice. We didn't have any children. After 8 years, we had 3 children. The amount of time and energy, you know, to take 3 young children. We had 3 kids under the age of, like, I think 4 at the time or 5, you know, so it was, you know, it's a lot. And what happened was we had a hurricane in 2017. And at that time, we had done well, and we had several commercial properties as well as, you know, the ABA business, and we were doing other things, had other businesses going. And our commercial properties just got devastated with the Hurricane Irma 2017. And so we had all our ACs were like underneath our suites, and they all got flooded. And so we had like 70 plus kids at this office, like without ACs for 2 weeks in Florida. So as you can imagine, that didn't go well. We looked at it and like, man, this is really tough. And then we got kids now, and like, how do we still show up as our best self and make sure kids are getting the clinical quality they need, like, and making sure like our marriage is important to us? Like, how do we do all this? And we looked around, and we had been in offers for a couple of years, and we didn't really like those offers, but we had some revenue sharing set up with some other folks in town that were doing it the right way, and folks we really believed in. And they said, hey, are you guys open to having a conversation? And my wife was like, yes, I am very open to having a conversation after 8 years. Like, I not still believe in the purpose, but just we're a little tired, just to be honest. And so that it was more about maintain the quality of life we wanted. And at that point, like, it was, you know, we were spread a little thin. And so we sought refuge in acquisition, but it's not for everybody. That process alone was long and hard and tedious, but it was something that worked out for us.
What's one piece of advice you would give to ABA organizations who are thinking about selling?
This should be an entire podcast series. Like this topic right here, there's so much. I would say, first of all, before you get to any disclosures, know who you're working with. Everybody's going to tell you, they're going to all say the right things. They're all going to say that they have the capital. They're going to all say they care about their purpose and the kiddos. But what's really important is where they see you after the acquisition is over. Do they expect you to become an employee? Are you going to fade out of the business? Are you going to be an employee, independent contractor, under an agreement? What do they envision? Not what you want, but what do they envision? What does success look like for them? Right? If they expect your team to take over and grow 15 offices in the next 3 years, that's important. That's something you want to know in the beginning. If what success looks like for them is based upon, a metric or a measure that is not important to you, find out before you open up the hood and show them everything, because you might do all that and then find out it's not a good fit. We actually had that. We, the first organization that we were going to sell to, we found out at the end, this is not a situation that we would feel comfortable with long term, and wasted several months in conversations, in due diligence and auditors and all this kind of stuff before that point. So I would say upfront, find out who they are and what they want. Not we want to buy you, but okay, at month six, what would you be doing? 2 years down the road, how would your kiddos are? For example, we saw kiddos all the way up to 18. Right. If somebody wants to come in and they only want to stop at 6 years old and do early intervention. Right. Hey, what does that mean for your other kiddos? Are they going to have to find new providers? Those are the kind of questions we all think about the money part of it. But think about the people. Are your employees going to be able to maintain the health benefits that you're accustomed to? PTO, culture, those kind of things. The rest of the stuff can take care of itself. But I would think to focus on who they are, what they want, and let the conversations go from there.
I love it. So get to know them, get to know what success looks like for them, not just for you, and think about it from your people's perspective. That's powerful. Ryan, tell me about the moment you handed the keys over. What emotions were you experiencing?
I was a wreck because I didn't want to let go. I didn't want to let go. I mean, you put your heart and blood in something and will you do it the right way? Can I really trust you? Because we truly were able to have 100% employees stay. Nobody left. Literally, it was 98% of the clients stayed. So because I believe we built something that was pretty cool, right? We had the right culture. And, I felt we had this dinner, a celebratory dinner, and everybody's there and we're at the restaurant, the whole deal, right? And I don't know if I'm supposed to be crying or laughing. me and my wife were oh my gosh, think about this, man. We go to high school for 4 years and think about the memories you have. You go to college, think about the memories you have in college for those four and 8 years of your life. So that's the period we spend at PBS. You know how many families we interacted with? We go to the grocery store, we see them, right? And they're like, hey, what's up, guys? Why are you guys doing this? That kind of thing. We go to the local high school football game to see our cousins play or stuff like that. And we see our coworkers and, folks we hired along the way. So it's one of those things to where it's bittersweet, but it was the right thing for us. It was the right decision for us at the time. And I would still make the same choice, but that doesn't mean I felt good about it when I did it. It was, it's your baby and you want to stay with it.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much. I want to close out with a section of just quick rapid fire questions for you. So you ready?
Okay. I think so. Okay.
Sorry. Yeah. Not to tee it up like this is some huge thing. Just quick. What comes to mind? Who's your biggest influence and why?
Jesus. I'm trying to base my life around how, the cliche, right? What would Jesus do? So Definitely Jesus.
If you could have dinner with one person in history, who would it be?
In history?
Anyone.
Ooh, because I was going to say my wife, but I'll pick her because I married her, right? But if I had to take it outside of her, I'm going to go with a president. I would take Barack Obama. I would really like to know, some of his thoughts, not just like on politics, but just in life. So I think it'd be pretty cool to have dinner with Barack Obama.
What's your favorite book?
The Bible. I know that's like cliche because I said Jesus already, but I'll say the Bible. It fits every situation, even the ones you don't like. So I will go with the Bible in a rapid fire.
Ed, if you could travel to any place around the world tomorrow, where would it be?
Ooh, rapid fire? I'm going to say Thailand. And it's only because, I really like Hangover 2, and I just I know it's a random movie, but if we're talking random stuff, Thailand. I've never been to Thailand. I don't know many people that have been to Thailand, but it's a very interesting place. So, and, I need another stamp in my passport, so I think I need to book a trip to Thailand now, Jonathan. But Thailand would be the place.
Hey, Ryan, thank you so much. This has been a ton of fun. I've really enjoyed our conversation. Congratulations on all the success that you've experienced. And I look forward to catching up again soon.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Building Better Businesses in ABA Podcast. Stay tuned for our next exciting episode. In the meantime, please like, subscribe, share, and comment. We value your feedback. Don't forget to follow us on social media at elementrcm.ai.